Art of Waging Small Business Warfare Podcast, teaching Davids how to defeat Goliaths. Now here's your host, Mark Anthony Peterson.
Welcome back to the podcast for entrepreneurs, startups, and business mavericks. If you're not a maverick, you don't have to go home, but you got to get up out of this podcast. In this podcast, we teach entrepreneurs how to defeat the corporate giant. Just like in the story of David and Goliath, David defeated a much taller and stronger Goliath, not by fighting the giant in hand-to-hand combat, but by using technology, a slingshot. The slingshot allowed the smaller David to attack from a distance that minimized the advantages that Goliath had over the smaller David. My name is Mark Anthony Peterson. I'm a serial entrepreneur, a futurist, and the managing executive at Serial Consulting, a leading small business strategy and technology consulting firm. I am also the author of the book Guerrillapreneur, Small Business Strategy for Davids Wanting to Defeat Goliaths, which is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and iTunes. This podcast is brought to you by Serial Consulting. An idea can launch a business. A strategy can take it global. Guys, support the show. Like the show. Share the show with your friends. But most importantly, make sure you subscribe. Help me out by also leaving a comment. Do it in iTunes. Do it in the Apple iPod app. Do it in Podomatic Speaker, Spotify, or any of your other favorite podcast platforms. Make sure you also go by and check us out on patreon.com/guerrillapreneur. We're going to bring a fab lab to the Black Belt South with your help. Guys, today's podcast episode is fascinating. I interview Philip Williams about his new book, Momentum Goal Setting, the anti-corporate method for setting goals that will truly grow your business. Now, as I mentioned, Philip is a regular on the Guerrillapreneur podcast. In episode 26, Philip asked the question, is your business solving the right problem? In episode 41, Philip talked to us about performance-driven cultures. And if you're a corporate strategist, an executive, or business consultant, this episode is going to blow your socks off. We're going to talk about momentum goal setting, and we're going to put the thumb in the eye of all the other frameworks that you've been using up to this point. Enjoy this interview with Philip Williams about his new book, Momentum Goal Setting, the anti-corporate method for setting goals that will truly grow your business. Guerrillapreneurs, welcome back to the podcast. We have another exciting segment with Mr. Philip Williams. Yes, the gentleman that's giving us the mini MBA. We're through sessions 1 and 2. If you didn't come to class, I wasn't taking names. You can go back and listen to those podcasts. Episode 26, Solving the Right Business Problem. You got to get in and listen to that one first because that sets the table. And then our next episode, Performance-Driven Culture, that's where we put the food on the table, really show you how to sustain and grow your business. Today, though, we're going to talk about the gravy. Yeah, he has a book, Momentum Goal Setting, the anti-corporate method for setting goals that will truly grow your business. This is going to be required reading for all guerrillapreneurs if you are serious about taking on the corporate giant. Now, Mr. Philip Williams is the 3-time Inc. 5000 honoree after becoming the CEO of a 17-year-old cash-strapped company, and he grew that company 50%, 50% per year for 5 straight years. If that's not good enough for you, I don't know what is, but I don't know anybody else that's out there doing that. And he's captured those secrets in his book, Momentum Goal Setting. Mr. Williams, welcome back to the podcast.
Mark, I always love talking to you. Thank you for having me. What, God, this is what, third time?
Third time, absolutely. All right, but this is going to be good because we're talking about your new book, Momentum Goal Setting. And then the rest of it really got me intrigued. The anti-corporate methods for setting goals that will truly grow your business. That's going to scare some of those people in the C-suite.
Yeah, it's kind of my little poke in the eye against stretch goals and big, hairy, audacious goals and, you know, all these other methods that seem to be getting sold out there. I didn't have a lot of luck with those myself, and I took a different approach. And I guess the long story of it is that I did what I did to build a business. And then when people started asking me how I knew how to do it, and I started explaining it to them, they kind of looked at me a little cross-eyed. And so I said, you know, I really need to, just for my own sake, so that I can stop getting these weird looks, I need to write this down and get it into some sort of coherent structure and see if there's any business cases or any research that backs me up, or did I just get lucky? And it really turns out that over the last 10 or 15 years, there's been so much goal-setting research that's come out that kind of backs what I did, that I was able to actually present it in a coherent argument, if you will. And so out of initially what was, I think, about 10,000 words of just mental stream of consciousness writing became Momentum Goal Setting.
The last podcast we had really knocked me back on my heels, because all the stuff that I'd been taught in business school, a lot of stuff that I was taught as a strategy consultant at one of the big strategy consulting firms, you knocked me right back on my heels and told me all that stuff was, for lack of a better term, crap. And you sold me. By the end of that podcast, Performance-Driven Culture, you sold me, because it made me understand that to grow an organization, you have to have the ideas come from the bottom up, and that you have to have goals set that people buy into and a metric that measures and teaches them how to create the capacity to grow. Really made me rethink how I approach business. So walk us through what you learned in the book, how you broke out the methodology, and I'd love to hear some of these case studies that align with what your central thesis is.
In the book, I actually outline sort of what I call my 12 sort of fundamental rules, if you will, when it comes to human beings. And it's like the very first thing I do is kind of set down a framework so everybody understands, you know, the world according to Phil, if you will. But these are really all things that tend to get people nodding yes. And I'll talk about those in a second, but I do want to address one thing, because people, they confuse goals and vision. So every leader has a vision for their business, whether it's you want to be number one, or you want to have offices in all 50 states, or, you know, whatever it is for your vision, you have a vision. The goals are the stepping stone to get to the vision, to achieve the vision. And it is your job as the leader to paint the vision. What I'm trying to get people to do with Momentum Goal Setting is to invite their team into the process of identifying the stepping stones and actually executing and delivering the stepping stones, which are the goals. And if you can separate those two in your mind for a moment and start to see that as the leader, I paint the vision, and then I help my team achieve their goals, which get us to the vision. If you can start looking at the world that way, it gets a little bit easier to absorb. But I said, look, you need to understand a few things about dealing with people, because at the end of the day, you probably understand it now if you've been leading a group of people for a little while, but you almost have to be like a closet psychologist and a student of human behavior to understand how to get a group of people to move in a direction toward a common goal. And I just developed these rules over my lifetime, like, human beings will normalize the situation that they're in. It's the old your price, my terms, or your terms, my price argument. You know, oh, you want that car for $15,000? Great, I'll give it to you on time payments at 7% a year. You know, it's sort of that idea, right? So as human beings, we will normalize the situation that we're in. We will somehow find a way to make it equal or fair to us, regardless of what that situation is. We're very creative. Human beings are fundamentally creative creatures. And that creativity can be unleashed for good or bad. The other thing is, I don't want to be surrounded by yes people. Yes people do not get me where I want to go. All that is an echo chamber. So I never want to be surrounded by yes people. I want my team to come and tell me when things don't go right. It is another rule. You've got to preserve your employees' dignity at all times. They must always have their dignity when they're doing their job. Other rules, like from time to time, you're going to come across somebody who doesn't fit in your team. Never use words that are really, really big. And to me, words like most people don't fit in our company. A majority of people don't fit in our company. A lot of people don't fit in our company. Those are really big words. It's probably more accurate to say some people don't fit in your company or some ideas don't work. Some of my other things, failure is okay. In fact, I embrace the Watson idea. Look, my team's going to fail. That's okay. As long as they learn from the mistake the first time, as long as we don't lose a client over it, as long as we don't bankrupt the company, that sort of thing, there's going to be failures. Because if you're trying to do anything, you're going to fall off the bicycle. And the important thing as the leader is our job to pick them up. So I use this lens that I look at the world through, and I laid out that at the very beginning of the book so people could understand where I come from when I look at the business. One of my other rules, when things don't go right, to me, that's an opportunity money. Great. I just found another way to make another $50. You know, all I can do is fix that and I'll start making a little more money. You know, problems, That's my job as a leader. I'm supposed to help my team solve problems. I'm not supposed to be the guy that beat somebody over the head because they had a problem. And so I lay all of that sort of that framework, that lens down in front of people, and I say, look, this is what I this is my framework for how I lead people. Everybody's from somewhere. They have a story. They have a background. They have history. They have knowledge. They have experiences. They're from somewhere. You've got to appreciate that background so that you can help lead them to really where they want to go and where you want your business to go. And then it's all about painting the vision and then crowdsource the ideas, the goals to your team. How do I get from where I am to this vision that I have for the business 3 to 5 years from now?
You set the table with the organization, giving them permission to fail and also giving them permission to succeed by offering up ideas that can transform the business. From their perspective, giving them permission to fail and succeed and the framework and tools on how to process both. If you're succeeding, here's how you measure that success in the context of our organization. If you fail, here's how to do a postmortem and to avoid those types of problems moving forward. But to have that open and honest dialogue on both ends to set the stage for what you've called a performance-driven culture.
Right. You know, when you're giving goals to people, assigned goals are, it's very interesting. There's been, so like, you know, we were talking about a little bit earlier, that there's been so much research over the last 10 or 15 years. You know, I think all of us would consider, as an example, Elon Musk. You know, here's a guy who's achieved some incredible things in his life, right? I mean, Tesla, SpaceX. I mean, there's an argument to be made that he's the modern day Howard Hughes. The guy misses over half of the big, hairy, audacious goals that he sets. Most people don't know that. I think it was the Wall Street Journal went back and looked, and I think it was half of the, out of the 21 goals that he'd announced publicly, his companies had hit 11 of them. In other words, they were failing to hit their big, hairy, audacious goals almost half of the time. And then it was really sort of fortuitous, as I was sitting down to write the book, one of the sharks from Shark Tank was interviewed by Inc. I think it was in March of 2018. And they asked him about, you know, what makes his companies profitable, and specifically what makes his companies that are headed by women, what makes them so successful? Because he's actually noticed that the companies that he has in his portfolio where he's made investments that are led by women hit their goals 95% of the time. The goals are, and the companies that are led by men only hit their goals 65% of the time. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. You know, what's going on there? And so he dug a little deeper into it, and he says, the companies that are led by women do a better job of setting more realistic goals. They don't tend to go for the big, hairy, audacious goal. And what that does, that has such a cascading effect through the company that it repeats itself, and it pays dividends years and years out. And he spoke to things like those companies that are led by women that use this goal setting approach that he was talking about, they hit their goals 95% of the time. That results in a happier employee base. Those companies also have much lower employee turnover, and their financial performance is far more reliable. And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. There's a case to be made for this kind of stuff. And it all boils down to this idea of, you know, goals do need to make people reach. But if they're gonna feel like they're failing a lot, you can only make a human being fail so much before they, again, normalize their situation and decide they're gonna go work somewhere else. And so there was all of these ideas swirling around in my brain. And, you know, I just started writing these things down about how I did what I did when I got that company to grow that fast for that length of time. And, it all boils down to a number of different, I'm very focused and concerned about how an employee views a goal when they're assigned that goal. And I'm very attuned, you know, people might call it EQ or whatever your term is, but I'm very tuned into what effect does that have on the employee when I give them this goal. That's really what I'm concerned about, because I don't want unintended consequences, and I don't want things like cheating, and I don't want them to feel discouraged either.
I know one of the things I've always been frustrated with as a baseball fan, teams that rely on the home run versus those that learn how to hit singles. And those teams that learn how to hit singles and manufacture runs can seem to sustain the level of success over longer periods versus those that go out and bring in the slugger and add them to the lineup. And it sounds like your methodology's making an argument for the team to put in a sustainable singles-driven approach where the goals are manageable, there's buy-in, and they're not as big and hairy as trying to get the ball over the fence with one swing.
Yeah, you know, one of the books that gave me a foundation, I read this book, gosh, I think probably in 1998 or 1999. The name of the book is called Managing Chaos, and I cannot remember for the life of me who the author is, but I can remember I have a photographic memory. The cover of the book is a picture of stars in the night sky. And it was really cool because the book compared Mickey Mantle and Babe Ruth. The argument in the book was that Mickey Mantle was a better hitter than Babe Ruth, even though Mickey Mantle didn't hit as many home runs as Babe Ruth, because he was far more consistent. It was that consistency that the book made the argument about. And if you're an engineer, you'll love it because it talks about process control charts and that sort of stuff. But that was something that that was really, that book just really, you know, to continue the analogy, it hit home with me about this idea of consistent performance. And it really, really did it for me. And then there was another research work that came out, gosh, probably about 15 years ago. And it came out about the time I was doing what I was doing, but I didn't really even find out about this document until I think probably 2 or 3 years ago. And it was written by Dr. Edwin Locke and Dr. Gary Latham. And it outlined sort of this whole, the name of the research document is, it's called, if you want to look it up, it's called Building a Practically Useful Theory of Goal Setting and Task Motivation, / a 35-year odyssey. So if you Google that, you'll find this document. But in that document, it's really interesting because they talk about this first filter that every employee views an assigned goal through. And it's very, it's so simple, it's not even funny. But when you give a goal to somebody, the first thing they do is compare it to the goal that they've set for themselves. So every employee you have should have a goal that they've set for themselves. And if they didn't set a goal for themselves, then that's a conversation that you need to have with them. And you need to find out, is this a person who is actually a goal setter or someone who's not? And then how do they fit in the organization? And if they don't fit, then what's a way that they can leave the business while maintaining their dignity? But the first thing that they do, according to Drs. Locke and Latham, is they look at the goal they set for themselves. And if the goal that you gave them is similar to the goal that they set for themselves, then generally what you're going to get is you're going to get execution. They're going to deliver on that goal that you've assigned to them. But if the goal is a big, hairy, audacious goal, if it's a stretch goal, then they're going to look to their self-belief. Do they believe in their heart, in their mind, and in their bones that they can hit the goal that you set for them? Those are the two things immediately, instantaneously. When you're standing in front of your team and you announce, here's the goal, that little diagram right there is what happens in the flash of a second. Is that goal like the goal I set for myself? If not, do I believe I can hit it? If I don't believe I can hit it, that's when you hear the snickers and the complaining in the lunchroom when you walk around the corner and all of a sudden everybody stops talking. You know, that's what happens almost instantaneously when you announce, here's the goal that we're going to hit, or when you hand a goal, you know, when you write down a goal and say, hey, Joe, you're going to go from 5 widgets a day to 8 widgets a day. If Joe's goal was 6, he's looking at you going, dude, do you have any idea how hard it is going to be for me to hit 6 and you just gave me 8? No way. That's what happens instantaneously. So it's the self-belief. What I tell people is how fast your business grows actually hinges on the collective self-belief of the employees in your business. Mm-hmm. Like it or not, that's how it works. Wow. It's all about self-belief.
So when everybody believes, the goals become achievable.
Yeah, they believe they're going to hit it. They believe they're going to execute. They believe. So then the question becomes, as a leader, how do you build self-belief in your organization? And if you have a business that's underperforming, my argument is that you need to spend time teaching your team that they can succeed and that they are, in fact, successful people. You need to spend time building their self-belief. And so if your business only grew 10% last year, my suggestion to you is, and actually Harvard Business Review would back me up on this, that you better figure out how to duplicate 10% growth at least one more year out. Don't come into your team and say, well, we only grew 10% last year, and my goal was to double the business in 24 months, so we have to grow 90% this year. The research says that the companies that should not set stretch goals are the ones that don't have a recent track record of executing on that goal. So if you didn't grow 90% last year, not necessarily the best idea to set the goal of growing 90% this year, unless last year was all about laying some groundwork, maybe buying some software or tapping into a new market. If you haven't laid the groundwork and all of a sudden you're walking in and setting a big, hairy, audacious goal, well, to quote the Wall Street Journal article that they wrote in January of 2017, the use of stretch goals in business is quite common. The successful use of stretch goals in business, however, is not, because it all comes back to self-belief.
Makes sense. It absolutely makes sense. And when you can look at an organization that needs to be transformed, essentially what you're saying is that you lay the groundwork, but in those early years, the expectations are similar in terms of performance to the prior years until the momentum begins to build on itself.
Yeah, it's almost like a weather forecast. Each and every day, there is an 80% chance that today's weather will be just like yesterday. Right?
Right.
So you've got to spend time building their self-belief. And it's a challenge, because each person's self-belief really hinges on four different levers. The first one is their own experience in that environment. And every person that's listening to this knows exactly what I'm talking about, because you've probably worked for somebody else before, or you've based the idea that you could do something on prior successes that you've had in your own life. So you first look to your own experience in the environment that you're in. That's the very first thing. And if you haven't succeeded before, or you haven't done something that allows you to believe that you could succeed in the future in that environment, then you're going to have a problem. That's the single biggest factor that affects a person's self-belief, is their own prior experiences. The next thing that affects their self-belief is the experience of their friends and their peers in a similar environment, or in the very environment that they're also in. So their coworkers, or maybe their friends that are in the same industry but at a different company. And those are the folks that have the next most influence on a person's self-belief. Like if my buddy Joe, who works two cubicles over from me, and he's really good at doing what he does, and he's never hit that goal, if he hasn't done it, then I can't do it. That conversation actually happens with a person in their own brain. So first, it's their own self, their own prior experiences. Then it's the experiences of their friends, their coworkers, their peers. That's the second lever. And then you get to the third lever, which is the pep talk, the positive reinforcement. And that's about as close as you're going to get to "because the CEO said so." You know, is it their wife? Is it their peers, their friends, their leaders? But literally the third most effective thing in getting somebody to believe that they can do it is the pep talk. That's why this idea of getting buy-in is such a struggle, because at best it's the third most effective thing. And then the fourth lever is what I call the butterflies in the stomach. And that is the feeling that they have right when you hit them with that goal. So if they feel like it's a good chance that they can do it, then you're okay. But when you announce that goal, the butterflies in the stomach, that is the easy place for you to win or lose. And if you don't have, I should say, if you do have a lot of, if they have a lot of butterflies in the stomach when you announce the goal, that's not really a good thing. You can flip that lever either way. You can flip it in a positive direction where their gut response to the goal is, hell yeah, let's go do this. Or you can flip it to the point where they practically chuckle as soon as they hear you say it. And those two responses are very, very important. So as you're announcing a goal to your team, you better be reading the room. What kind of responses? What are you seeing in their faces? You know, what are you hearing them say? You know, when you walk around the corner to the lunchroom, what's the conversation? is he crazy because we've never done this before, or is it, oh, I love this, I'm going to go, you know, I'm going to go do this, this, and this, and this is going to be an easy piece of cake for me. Those are the four things. Those are the four ways that a leader influences a person's self-belief. And not a single one of them is called because the CEO said it could be done.
What are some case studies that align with the methodology that you've outlined?
The vast majority of the work that you can find out there in the literature has to do more with the negative of it. But one of the one of the better positive ones is, I don't know if you've ever heard of the newspaper Investor's Business Daily. I think it's gone mostly toward the internet, but it's founded by a guy by the name of William O'Neill. And in it, he talks about this idea. He's written a number of books about it. He had an investment methodology, and he gave it an acronym called CAN-SLIM. And the whole thing that he did, his entire investment methodology, he went back and he looked at successes that other mutual fund investors had had. And he outlined seven different things that happen inside the business. And then all he did was copy what they did in the best case scenarios. So one of the things that he wanted to do was figure out, hey, you know, these mutual funds, they keep kicking it every time. They're just doing an amazing job at growing their portfolios. How is it that they're doing? And he noticed that each one of these companies, and we talked about earlier how, you know, if you had a 10% year, how are you going to be able to have another 10% year or even a 90% year? And, you know, what do you do to make that happen? Well, you've got to have something new going on. You can have a new leader, which, you know, most of us, we don't really want that. We want to stay the leader. You can have a new technology, you can have new clients, you have new markets, those sorts of things. So have you spent time developing something new in your business, a new technology? All of the case studies, when you go and you look at Wall Street, that new element is really, really important when you look at companies that have performed. And Apple, by far and away, is probably one of the most common examples of companies that can really break free from this. And the new thing that they did kind of two new things. The first new thing that they did was they replaced the chief executive and brought Steve Jobs back. I don't want anybody to have to do that. But what Steve Jobs did, he introduced a new technology, and that was the iPod. He also got rid of the things that were not adding value to the business. And when he did that, before he did it, he actually went and talked to the salespeople that were selling the computers that they had when he returned to the company. And so that's why I talk about crowdsourcing your ideas for how you improve. When he went down and he talked to his sales team, at the time, I think they were on like 15 different computers. And what he heard from the sales team was that there was so much crossover between their product lines that they themselves were confused about what to sell to the customer. And so he went back and he said, okay, well, we're going to fix that problem for everybody. And he cut them down from 15 computers and laptops to two computers and two laptops so that they knew what to sell to people. That actually improved their revenue and it improved their profitability. So when you look at helping your team, that was one of the best examples that I can think of where he went down and he said to his team, what's making it hard for you to do your job? And they said, well, we don't know what to sell to people. And so he said, okay, boom, and made it easier for them. And then that helped them be confident in what they were doing. It's not three choices. It's one choice or it's two choices, but it's not three or five or whatever. It's not one of 15. So you've got to take a look at what's going on the positive side, where you can help your team. And then, you know, we've mentioned before companies like Sears and Wells Fargo and a really, really bad case is Enron, where the teams just didn't believe in the goal that was given to them. And so they wound up cheating the goals. And in the case of Enron, it absolutely destroyed the company. Wells Fargo has spent a god-awful, incredibly ugly amount of money trying to fix it. Sears has been on a slow decline for a few decades now and will finally evaporate probably in the next 24 to 36 months. I think that they just had a bankruptcy judge approve yet another plan. This is where this belief model, this personal experience, this vicarious experience becomes very, very important. And so you can find these examples of success, though, in your own business.
Eliminating all those models makes it easier for people to make good decisions when there are fewer options all the way through the organization in every position. So he streamlined the company and gave them the opportunity to come up with better ideas to sell what they had left. And that unlocked the door to creating a lot more momentum. I love that.
It's actually so, to me, it just seemed very, very natural to be able to do something like that. What you could do is, and the approach that I take when I go into a company is, and I just ask somebody, you start walking around, hey, look, we grew at 25% last year. What are a few things that we could do in your job that would help you duplicate that? And when I talk to companies about, okay, so you're trying to, you know, you want to start growing. It's not going to be an instantaneous thing. There's a good chance that you'll do better than you did last year. How are you going to get that done? You know, we don't want to set a 90% goal when last year we did 10, but we certainly do want to make sure that we reduplicate the 10. So what I tell people is I say, okay, so you take a look at your business because you've got to draw on your team's personal experience in your company. That's where you're going to have the biggest bang for your buck. You know, their friends and peers that are inside the company are useful to you. Their friends and peers in other businesses, not so much. Pep talks are good, but that's really at the end of the day, a distant number three. You need their personal experiences. So you go back to them and you say, hey, look, last year we grew 10%. And in fact, when you look at it, it really boiled down to 3 or 4 months that were super strong, where they were like 25 or 30% months, and they really carried the year, and that's how we got it. My question for you, Joe, down here on the front line dealing with the customer every day is, what are the things that you do? Give me three things that would allow you to duplicate those 3 months that you had last year. You know, Joe, I looked at your numbers and, you know, June was a great month for you, August was a great month for you, and November was a great month for you. Think about what happened in those months and give me an idea, what are the three things that made those months possible for you? And all you want to do is focus on doing those three things repeatedly. I just want to know that every month, January through December, those three things that made those great months for you possible, what are they? How can we focus on making sure that those are going well for you all of the time? And then conversely, on the other side of the coin, there's places where we have bad months. You might look back and you look at your business and you say, well, geez, you know, March was no good, July was no good, and, you know, October was no good. Those were tough months. When we have those bad months, what are the things that we did or didn't do that caused those bad months to happen? And if we can stop shooting ourselves in the foot in those three or four ways, then all of a sudden our performance gets a lot better. So when you talk about helping somebody believe that they can duplicate last year's success, it's pick three things that you know when you do them well, they cause good things to happen, and pick the three ways you're going to stop shooting yourself in the foot And if we do those things, and if we just work on doing them every month, month in and month out, I know we're going to grow 10%. We're going to duplicate that success that we had last year, whether it was 10 or 15 or whatever. And you continuously encourage your team to focus on those ideas. And then when you talk about the months where you're trying to get better, if you enlist them, invite them into that vision that you have for the business, and ask them, what are the ways that they can get better, and what are the ways that you can invest in them to help them get better and make sure that they're hitting that number all of the time, and then you're able to give it to them so that they can repeat their successes. That's how you're building on that personal experience that they're having inside your business. And that's how you're building that self-belief, so that when you announce next year that you want to grow the business 20%, because that's what you did last year when you were trying to grow 10 and you accidentally grew 20, that's the method. At the end of the day, it's truly that simple.
What has been the reception for your book?
I read the reviews, and it's just, it's a little bit humbling. I think there was one person in there that wrote that's literally why she quit her last two jobs. If she had been working for leadership that functioned that way, she would have never left those two jobs. She absolutely loved what she did for a living, but she left because the practices were completely opposite. But the reviews have just been very humbling to see how people are reacting to it.
I can understand. As I mentioned in our last podcast, Performance-Driven Culture, I underwent a transformation during the podcast, understanding how to really rethink how to unlock value in an organization. And it really does get back to some of the basic axioms that you hear all the time. It's about the people and empowering the people, giving them the right tools and the right approach to delivering value with the jobs that they have. And we get so caught up in corporate methodologies and structures and systems that we miss the obvious, which is empowering the people. And your momentum-based approach takes back to our roots of how some of the great organizations have been built, and more importantly, how some of the people within those organizations have been inspired to be leaders. And I mean those people on the front lines have been inspired to be leaders, whereas in other organizations, they've been inspired to hit higher and higher widget numbers. So yeah, I will be one of those people giving you a review like that as well, because I thought of myself as someone that knew a little bit about some of the methodologies, but I'll be burning a lot of that stuff in a bonfire in a week.
Well, thank you for that, Mark. That's really good to hear. I mean, I really did want to sort of, I build it as a poke in the eye, if you will, to you know, all of these methodologies, and I've had the interesting experiences where I sit in front of somebody and they say, well, you know, my company's taking on this new approach to goal setting this year. We're going to do BHAGs, you know, these big, hairy, audacious goals. And I had one manager, I circled back with him a year later and I said, so how did your review go? I wanted to understand what happened with, you know, your big, hairy, audacious goals. And he said, well, Phil, he says, I'm going to give you the exact quote for my performance review. And I'm currently looking for a new job, but here was what my manager told me. And I'll see if I can quote it verbatim. This is going to be really, really close to what he was told. This is the actual statement. It sounded like it came straight out of a Dilbert comic strip. While my contributions to the organization were significant, my company was unable to monetize them successfully, and so I won't be receiving a raise or a bonus this year. And I said, wow, that sounds really, really bad. And he says, here's what really, really frustrates me. My goals were given to me by my leadership team at the beginning of the year, and I hit every single one of my goals 100%. I did exactly what they asked me to do. And at the end of the day, I get nothing for it. I don't get a raise. I don't get a bonus, nothing. I didn't even really get a thank you. Actually, my review, when you look at it, doesn't look like I did very good at my job. But I did, when you look at my goal package that they gave me, I did everything they asked me to do. Wow, that's just doesn't seem, you know, I can't blame him. I can't blame him for wanting to go out and find a new place to work, you know. And so the whole idea was, hey, look, we've got to paint visions for our teams, but we really need to involve them in how we get there. And, you know, for everybody, you're not going to be able to do 100% of what your team wants. And that's really, you know, not the idea. But you do want to do a lot of it. And you want to teach them that they can be successful. And you don't want to have the Dilbert written reviews with your team where it says, well, you did everything I asked, but it really didn't help. It's all about how can we get it done. What you will find if you follow the methodology in this book, and this is the reason that I chose the word momentum in the title, is if your team grew at 10% last year, and you go out and you say, look, guys, we're going to stop shooting ourselves in the foot these three ways, and we're going to start each of us in our own role. And you just ask each person to identify the three things that if they do these things, and sometimes it's three or four, whatever it is, but it's not 18, it's just a handful. If you just do these three things well, you know you're going to be successful all the time. And if we each do that, I know we're going to hit 10%. What will really happen is that you won't hit 10%. You'll start hitting 15 and you'll start hitting 20. And then you can come back to your team and you can go, hey guys, look, we just worked on doing these three things really well last year. Each of us, we did our own three things really, really well as a group. The marketing group did these three things. The operations group did these three things. Finance did these three. And the company, we focused overall on these three, you know, we made these three concepts, these three ideas really, really important at a company level. I just did my three things. Each person, we just did those three things. We stopped shooting ourselves. And now we accidentally grew 20%. So that's our new goal this year, is just to match what we did last year. It turns into a darn snowball. It just turns into a snowball rolling down a hill. And the thing takes on a life of its own. And that's why I talk to people about this quote from Steve Jobs, this idea that if you get 10 people that are really passionate about something, then what happens is over time, that group of people becomes self-policing. And they begin to identify themselves as a group of people that perform at a certain level. And they're really passionate about making sure that they continue to perform at that level and that anybody else that comes into the team does the same.
It makes sense. It absolutely makes sense. And you're right. If you had a goal for 10% and the team accidentally stumbles into 15 or 20, you just set in place the mechanism you talked about at the beginning of the podcast, those four rules. I now realize I can do 20%. I saw my peers do the same. So it's reinforcing. And there's no doubt in my mind that if I reapply the methodology, find the three things that I did to get to that 20%, emphasize those, and then de-emphasize those things that kept me from getting to those goals, that I'll be able to sustain the 20% going forward. Like I said, it becomes a snowball because they do that, they're going to accidentally hit 25, and they're going to hit 30, and then they're going to hit 50. And it's a beautiful way to think about momentum building within an organization.
The really cool thing about it is the fastest way to get there is when you act on their ideas. And again, you're not going to be able to act on 100% of their ideas. But when you're including their ideas in how they're going to execute on these goals, and you're backing them, you're training them, you're funding them, you're investing in them on their ideas, they take ownership. Then what happens, the evolution of the organization isn't so much about the leader trying to pull everybody toward this vision. It becomes one where the leader is going, oh, goodness, look at this group over here. They're really flying. And they told me that, you know, when they hit this point, this is what they're going to need next. Then it becomes one where the leader is the fullback and he's trying to blow holes in the defense so that his running back can keep carrying the ball as fast. It's so interesting and exciting to see how the organization changes. You know, you go from trying to push people in a certain direction to realizing, oh my goodness, I need to line up a bigger line of credit because my team's moving faster than I thought they were going to. It is an entirely different class of problems to have.
Right. No, I heard a speech by Jack Welch and it sounded exactly like that. That at a certain point, his job was cheerleading and blocking and tackling and moving all the barriers out of the way of the people who were coming up with the best ideas. And so it is an approach that is fascinating. Where can people find this book? I'm sure after they hear this podcast, they are going to be excited. Some of them are not going to believe it. They're going to have to read it and study it. Where can they find this book?
You can find the book on Amazon. If you go to Amazon and search through books and just type in Momentum Goal Setting, that book's going to come up number one. And I dare anybody to give it a shot. You give this method an honest shot. And I'm talking, when I say an honest shot, I want 12 months out of you. You give it an honest shot, you will be happy with the results. There's no way. There's no way you can't not be happy.
After they've gotten the book, given it 12 months, how can they get in contact with you?
So you can get in touch with me through my website at askphilipwilliams.com. You can also get in touch with me on LinkedIn. We can connect there. I'm Philip-Williams, or dash, depending on how you think about it. Philip is spelled with one L. And there's a number of other different resources on the website, too, that are all free. So feel free to download those at your leisure. But those are the easy ways to get in touch with me.
Well, Philip, I've enjoyed talking to you about your book, Momentum Goal Setting, The Anti-Corporate Method for Setting Goals That Will Truly Grow Your Business. You can find it on Amazon. Just go in and type in Momentum Goal Setting or put in Philip Williams and select books. It'll pop up there as well. Get over to his website. Get on LinkedIn. Find him there. We're going to put all of those links in the show notes so you can find Philip Williams and his book, Momentum Goal Setting, The Anti-Corporate Method for Setting Goals That Will Truly Grow Your Business. It is a true poke in the eye to the old methodologies and a fresh way to think about building sustainable growth. Again, sir, thank you again for being on the podcast and teaching us a little bit more about how to create sustainable businesses.
Thank you for having me, Mark. I always enjoy talking with you and spending time with you.
Guys, didn't I tell you this was going to be a great episode? Momentum Goal Setting. Thank you, Mr. Philip Williams of AskPhilipWilliams.com, for a terrific interview. If you didn't catch the other episodes where we interview Philip Williams, please go back and do so. Episodes 26, is your business solving the right problem? 41, performance-driven culture. And now this one, episode 43, great episode about his new book, Momentum Goal Setting. We have one more interview with Philip scheduled, and we're going to round out the mini MBA. As soon as we get that on the calendar, we're going to let you guerrillapreneurs know so you can have pen and pad out to take notes, and then we're going to have graduation. We're going to move those tassels from one side to the other because your mini MBA will be complete. Please share the show, subscribe, leave comments. All of those things help us keep the guerrillapreneur movement growing. Please also make sure you go and check out our Patreon page. I am launching a new line of accessories. Yeah, Guerrillapreneur hat and t-shirts. And all of the Patreons will be able to get the first access to the new gear. Guys, why don't you check out some of my other podcasts? If you're really big into the gig economy and the sharing economy, check out my podcast, Gigging, Everything in the Sharing Economy. You can find it in all the same places that you can find Guerrillapreneur. And if you're still in corporate America and you haven't made the leap out to become an entrepreneur yet, check out my podcast, Career Coaching X's and O's. It's the podcast for corporate executives who want that corner office. I give you all of the advice from my years of working in corporate America before I became a serial entrepreneur. Guerrillapreneurs, Scott Sullivan said it best in episode 7. Be a mace, sharpen those spikes, and remember, if you're not breaking something, your company might be the next thing that gets broken.
Thank you for listening to the Guerrillapreneur, the Art of Waging Small Business Warfare podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, you may also enjoy the book Guerrillapreneur, Small Business Strategy for Davids Wanting to Defeat Goliaths, available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and iTunes. Follow Mark Peterson on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Guerrillapreneur. Now I want to close with a quote from the great Chinese military strategist Sun Tzu. Victorious warriors win first and then go to war, while defeated warriors go to war first, then seek to win. Keep fighting, guerrillapreneurs.